Committee on Environment and Natural Resources will come to order. Quorum is present. Almost a year and a half ago, myself and several other legislators were had the privilege of visiting the site of a new type of mining in Minnesota called non-ferrous mining. It was the site of the old LTV taconite mine. And we learned a lot about mining on that day. Since then, a lot of discussion has ensued about the proposed non-ferrous mining in Minnesota, not just Polymet, but other projects. Recently, a draft environmental impact statement was issued by the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. A bill has been introduced, and political lines have been drawn. For this committee, it is important to understand what non-ferrous mining is about. A lot of work has gone into making sure that the hearings that are going to ensue over the next couple of days are an objective process with all interests being heard. Our goal is to ensure that we have jobs in Minnesota and protect the environment. That is our objective. Why is it that this committee is having this hearing? It's simple. Just as I was invited as a key legislator on these issues to visit the site, the Senate's Environment and Natural Resources Committee has jurisdiction and oversight over the Department of Natural Resources, which has overseen and worked on this particular project. It is therefore incumbent upon this committee, legislators who represent all Minnesotans, to understand what this new type of industry that's coming to Minnesota is about. It is worth having this hearing just for that sake. But the fact of the matter is that certain concerns have been raised. We will find out whether those concerns are valid. In this committee, when we have confronted controversial issues, whether it be ATVs, wetlands, lead bullets, whatever it may be, we have held objective fact-finding hearings and discussions to understand what the truth is about each issue, regardless of the political interest. That is what we're doing with this issue today. What has happened as a result of those previous issues that we've confronted is oftentimes, in the case of the three I cited, a lot of issues that have come out on the table, misperceptions that have been resolved, and solutions that have been supported by both sides of an issue. Can or will that happen with this issue? I cannot say. I was not able to say with those other issues either, but we have a successful track record in this committee of being fair to all sides of an issue and to first determine if a problem exists and whether that an appropriate solution can and should be introduced. So with that, I want to allow the courtesy of the author of the bill just 1 minute to explain why he's bringing his proposal further. He's going to be given more time on Wednesday night to go further into detail of his legislation. But to kick the hearings off, I want to Senator Carlson to talk just a little bit. And even though the bill is not on the agenda, he has a proposed amendment to distribute for members and the public's consideration. Today we will be hearing about the history of mining in Minnesota. We will also be hearing from Polymet on what the North Met project is about. Tonight we will be getting into more details on what the draft environmental impact statement contains discussion surrounding that. And then on Wednesday night, we will have the Senator Carlson's bill before us with appropriate testimony. As I said earlier, Staff, mainly Mary Ann Hecht, has worked nights and weekends to involve all interested parties in the process of establishing this agenda and making sure that all sides are heard with as objective a process as possible and equal time to all sides. That is our objective, and before we start, I want to make sure that the committee knows that this is not my process, this is ours. If you all have any comments on our process as before we move on, I'd certainly like to hear them. We will certainly get into questions about the substance of this issue as we go. With that, Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Thank you so much for having this style of informational session, and it appears like we're going to have at least two sessions, and then we're going to be speaking about the bill. The information that you're about to hear is something that we all need to see. We need to see about an exciting new industry that's going to happen in Minnesota. And this is the, and it's unfortunate that we define it in a non-definition. This is kind of like defining, let's say, nuclear power as non-coal, or maybe deer hunting as non-fish. This is the non-ferrous mining proposal. Non-ferrous mining is addressing a particular area, particular deposit that happens to be up in the Iron Range, and we're looking at the development of this type of mining, and I'm seeing this as an exciting new opportunity for Minnesota, something that's going to bring a lot of jobs to the state, but with it goes certain risks, certain new risks that we haven't seen in Minnesota before. So what we need to do is we need to listen and learn. And I'm hoping that we get all of our questions or most of our questions answered in the next few days. One of the reasons why I'm sitting here right now is to help with that definition of being a non-ferrous industry. And to react to some of the things that we've been hearing, we've drafted an amendment that addresses that kind of connection that is misappropriately being used in connecting it to the iron mining industry. And that is that we're looking at requiring different things for this type of mining than what has been used in the ferrous mining industry. And so to react to that, what we've done is we've drafted an amendment to the bill. You do not have the bill, but you will have the amendment. And this absolutely positively clarifies that this bill does not have anything to do with iron mining. It is a non-ferrous mining bill. It does not change ferrous mining or iron mining in Minnesota. So thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. And we will have lots of time for questions.
Thank you, Senator Carlson. And Senator Carlson wanted this proposed amendment passed out. The bill is not before us today, but he indicates that this is language that he will be offering up as an author's amendment on Wednesday night when the bill will be before us. Okay. I believe are these available to the public as well?
I believe
they
so
will be.
Yeah.
All right. The first item on the agenda is to first examine a history of mining in Minnesota. Mr. Vadas, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Marty Vadas, and I'm the Director of the Lands and Minerals Division for the Department of Natural Resources, and I've been asked to give a high-level overview of the current mining in Minnesota and also then to look at exploration stage projects that are going on in the state, and that includes many of the non-ferrous that are of interest. And I also have a few slides on the significance of Minnesota's mineral resources. The place I'd like to start is the Mesabi Range, and this slide is a typical cross-section of the geology of the range. The range is about 110 miles long and 2 miles wide. Slice through it. This is what that deposit looks like, and this is where most of the iron resources that are available in Minnesota still remain. There are six active taconite operations in Minnesota, and they produce about $2.7 billion worth of resource per year. And they produce a 65% iron product. The first operation going from west to east is Keewatin Taconite, and that's owned by U.S. Steel and produces about 5 million tons of taconite. Next one is Hibbing Taconite. It's owned by Arcelor Middle Cleveland Cliffs and U.S. Steel. It's operated by Cleveland Cliffs and has a capacity of about 8 million tons. The next operation is Mintac. That's owned wholly owned by U.S. Steel and has a capacity of about 14 million tons. Next operation, thank you. Next one to the east is the Minorca mine, and that's owned by ArcelorMittal Steel, and it has a capacity of about 3 million tons. And finally, the last operation.
Mr. Vadas, where was the Mintac mine located?
Mintac is near Mountain Iron. It's on the center of the Iron Range.
Okay.
And the North Shore mining is the last operation to the east, and that's owned by Cleveland Cliffs and has an annual production of about 4.8 million tons. And this is a look
at... Where is that located?
That's located in Babbitt, and the processing facility is located in Silver Bay.
And where is Minorca?
Would you like to back up to that?
Where is Minorca located?
Minorca is just east of the town of Virginia.
Okay.
What we have on this map, those are the areas of the permit to mine for each of those operations.
Very good.
Next up, then, is a look at the last couple of years of production of iron ore from these operations and also the employment numbers. And as you can see, between 2007 and 2009, there was a large drop in production. And as a matter of fact, in 2009, this is the year with the least iron shipped from Minnesota since the Great Depression. It was a very, very bad year for iron ore production that goes back 70 or 80 years. And there was a time during 2009 when all of the taconite plants were idle at the same time. And that hasn't happened since the early 1980s. But in the bigger perspective, if about 75% of all iron that's produced in the United States comes from Minnesota. So Minnesota has a national significance as far as iron resources.
Could you repeat that number?
Year in and year out, Minnesota produces about 75% of all the iron ore produced in the United States.
Even in 2009?
Even in 2009.
Thank you.
Next, I'd like to talk about a new project and a new process. And Mr. Chair, I have some samples, but in the interest of time, I won't pass them around unless you'd like me to.
I'll pass them out.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Senator Frederickson.
Mr. Chairman, while they're being passed around, I do have a question, Mr. Vadas.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, those first two samples are a sample of a typical taconite ore, and also I have some the Mesabi nuggets, which is the next to talk about. And this is a very new process. It's located at the former LTV Steel, a portion of the former LTV Steel Mining Company. And this is a first ever in the world process that's been developed and here in Minnesota. And it produces a pig iron nugget, and they were first produced in January 12th of this year. And this facility has a capacity to produce 600,000 tons of pig iron. And this is the product, and I have a sample there. Instead of the 65% iron that's in a taconite pellet, this product is a 97% iron product. And the significance of this is that this can be used in not only blast furnaces, but also electric arc furnaces. So like the North Star Steel plant in East St. Paul, they can't use taconite in their process because the procedure won't let them do that. But they could use this pig iron product. So it just opens up a whole new market for Minnesota Iron Resources with this Mesabi nugget process in place.
Senator Frederickson, you had a question.
Mr. Chairman, I did. Mr. Vadas, you stated that 75% of all the iron ore produced in the United States comes from Minnesota. What percent of the iron ore used in the United States come from domestic sources versus international sources.
Mr. Vadas.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fredrickson, most all of the iron ore that's consumed in the U.S. at the moment does come from U.S. sources. There have been periods of time in the past, and I have a slide that addresses that, where iron ore has been imported from other countries. But my memory is that at the moment, the world market for iron ore is very good, and so those iron units are going other places in the world than coming into U.S.
Thank you.
Mr. Vadas.
Next one I'd like to talk about is a project called Esser Steel Minnesota, and this is a project where they plan on beginning construction of a new mine processing facility and steel mill near Nashwauk. This facility is currently permitted to produce 3.5 million tons of pellets that would go into making steel slabs. The company has decided that they would like to increase that production to 6 million tons, and so they're proceeding with an environmental review that would be aimed at increasing production before the plant is even built. Another newer process that I want to tell you about is called magnetation, and this is a company that received permits in 2008 to reprocess natural ore tailings and natural ore waste rock piles from the Iron Range. They have developed a way to extract the iron ore from that waste product of that was mined 50 or 60 years ago and produce a 65% iron concentrate from that. In 2009, they produced 80,000 tons of this concentrate and are interested in expanding their operations. And so sort of from a worldwide perspective, how does Minnesota stack up? I've listed the three main sources of world iron ore: Australia, Brazil, and that's about 39 billion tons of reserves that are identified there. China has about 21 billion tons of somewhat lower grade iron reserves, and Minnesota, by comparison, has 5 billion tons. And so on a worldwide basis, Minnesota's iron resource is not insignificant. This, I think, tries to illustrate sort of how that world ore dynamic works. There's a company based in South America, Vale. They produce iron ore pellets and also iron ore fines and sinter that go to the European market, and they also sell to the China market. And BHP and Rio Tinto in Australia are the major producers, and they ship mainly to China. And so Minnesota historically has had a competitive advantage in iron in that it's cheaper to get Minnesota ore to the inland steel mills than it is to import it from foreign sources. And so in the past, there has been iron ore used on the seaboard, some of the steel facilities, but Minnesota does have that something of a competitive advantage in that regard. Moving on then, I'd like to talk about sand and gravel aggregate mines in Minnesota. And there are approximately 300 of those mines, and about 50 million tons of sand and gravel are mined annually. And the value of that is right around $250 million. There are sand and gravel operations in Minnesota's 87 counties, and represents a significant amount of mining in Minnesota. Next is crushed stone, and you can see the stars on this map that show the locations of crushed stone quarries, and about 11 million tons of crushed stone are produced annually for a value of about $110 million. And these are developed mainly in areas where there aren't natural sand and gravel resources, and so this is used in making aggregate and blacktop pavement. The next is dimension stone. And Minnesota has a number of dimension stone producers, and about 25,000 tons of dimension stone are mined annually in Minnesota. And we are home to the largest dimension stone producer in the U.S. That's Cold Spring Granite Company. And I have a couple of examples of that. There's a Kasota stone that's made by Vetter Stone Company. And this is actually some Duluth complex that's mined for a dimension stone by Cold Spring Granite.
Dimension stone is granite, basically?
Mr. Chair, geologically, there are many different kinds of rock that go into making dimension stone, but most people think of it as granite. Granite's one example, but that Vetter stone is actually a limestone dolomite, which is a much different kind of rock, and they're all, most types of rock are amenable to making dimension stone. And it's used at, all around the Capitol here, for example, and tombstones and sink tops and countertops and that sort of thing.
Thank you.
Next is peat, and in Minnesota there are 13 peat mines that mine about 50,000 tons of horticultural peat each year. And in Minnesota we have three silica sand operations, and they're located, in, as you can see, in southern Minnesota. And silica sand we have here in Minnesota is a very special sand. It's very rounded grains of quartz, and it has a variety of specialized uses, including glass making, abrasives, filtration, and also it's used in oil well recovery. It's called frac sand. It's pumped down at very high pressure, and it opens the pores and improves recovery of oil and gas in oil fields. And so this sand is shipped all over the world, including Saudi Arabia. Next is Minnesota kale and clay, and you can see in southern Minnesota there have been a number of kale and clay operations, and it's mainly been used in the making of cement and bricks. This one really should have been in the prospective category of the talk. This is not an active operation, but there is an effort by a group called Cooperative Mineral Resources, which is a subsidiary of Crow Wing Power Electric Cooperative, to take a bulk sample of a high-grade manganese deposit in central Minnesota. In the center bottom of the map, that's Lake Mille Lacs. And this is the former Cuyuna Range, which was mined for many, many years. But today it's inactive. And this company, Cooperative Mineral Resources, is in the middle of environmental review to take a test sample, a bulk sample of this material for processing. And just to give you some perspective, the United States uses about 400,000 tons of manganese annually, and none is mined in the United States. There are five projects, that mining projects, that are in environmental review with DNR right now. And those are PolyMet, and you're going to hear more about that in a minute, so I won't mention that. Keewatin Taconite, which is one of our six taconite operations, is in the middle of an EIS to increase the capacity of their plant by 3.5 million tons of taconite. Mesabi Nugget, which is that makes that high-grade nugget that I passed around, is proposing to start a taconite mining operation at a portion of the former LTV mining site. And what they would like to do is supply their own concentrate to make these nuggets. At the moment they're purchasing that concentrate, they would like to start a mine so they can make their own. Esser Steel, currently, as I mentioned, has decided to move forward with environmental review to increase the capacity of their plant by about 2.5 million tons. And I just mentioned Cooperative Mineral Resources. They're in the middle of an EAW to take their bulk sample. So moving on then more to, instead of mining projects that are in advanced exploration stage, the mineral potential of Minnesota really
Excuse me, Mr. Vadas.
Yes.
Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Vadas, just so that I'm clear, I think you said ESSER is under an environmental review because they're going to expand. So are mines required to go through another study when they project a certain, is it any amount, or is it a certain amount of new production, or what's the rule that triggers that?
Mr. Vadas.
Mr. Chair, perhaps we could invite Steve Colvent or Steve Hirsch up. The EQB rules do provide that if there are expansions over a certain amount or additions to processing facilities, that there's mandatory environmental review, and what will be done is a supplemental EIS. So it'll take what was done already and then look at the impacts of that additional increase in mining and processing. If there's a 25% expansion in operation, then it requires environmental review.
Great.
Thank you.
Moving on then, really the potential of mineral development in Minnesota is 100% driven by what kind of bedrock geology we have, because that dictates what, if any, mineral deposits you would have in the state. And what we're looking at here is a bedrock geology map of Minnesota, and I'm going to really focus on two areas of this bedrock map. And the first one is something called the Canadian Shield. And this is a very old, 2.7 billion-year-old rock, and it's called the Greenstone Formations of the Canadian Shield. And this map illustrates the mineral deposits that occur in that same bedrock in Canada. And so what we have here with the stars and squares and so forth in Canada is mines of gold and base metals and iron deposits that are in those greenstone formations. And it's that same age and same kind of geology that runs into northern Minnesota. And the kinds of deposits that are typical in that sort of geologic terrain are called volcanogenic massive sulfides, and I have a sample of that. This is very, very high-grade copper and zinc ore. It came from Ontario. So we don't have this discovered in Minnesota, but Minnesota holds the potential for this sort of deposit to occur because of the geology that we have.
Which color is gold on that map?
On this map, gold is the stars. Mr. Chair, I also have a sample that came from near Ely of a short intersection that has about a quarter of an ounce of gold per ton of ore. So if you think gold is worth about $1,000 an ounce or so now, this would be about $250 a ton, which, you know, if there was enough of it, would be economic. But those are just examples of the kinds of deposits that occur in that geologic terrain. And looking then at a different kind of map, this is the Aeromag map that was funded by the LCMR over six bienniums. And this shows the magnetic features of the bedrock of Minnesota. And it's a little busy, but on this map, there are Canadian mineral occurrences that are shown for gold, nickel, copper, and zinc. And those are the different colored dots in Canada. And then also on this map, we have lands that have been leased for mineral exploration, state-owned lands. And as you can see, they generally follow those greenstone trends on into Minnesota. And those have been areas that have been explored, but to this date, no gold or massive sulfide deposits have been discovered here yet, but the bedrock holds that potential. This map shows the mineral exploration drilling that's been done in Minnesota from 1905 till last year, and the distribution is about 6,000 drill holes have been drilled for about 2.5 million feet of drilling. And in case you are unaware of what it takes to drill bedrock, I have a diamond drill bit here. This bit has actual diamonds embedded in here, and it drills a drill core similar to the one that I passed around there.
Is that the typical width?
About 2.5 inches in diameter or so is typical width for the size of the drill hole.
What you showed us, is that typical?
It is. It's a little smaller than what's being drilled today. Today it's a little larger than that. Next slide, in case you weren't aware, we do have a drill core library in Minnesota, and that's located in Hibbing. And companies are required when they do their exploration to turn over at least a quarter portion of the drill core after they've terminated a lease. And that's available to the public, to anyone that's interested in looking at that drill core. The next I'd like to talk about is the next geologic unit is the Duluth Complex. And this is that area of northeastern Minnesota shown in brown here. It runs about from Duluth to Ely to Grand Marais. And it's about a 1.1 billion-year-old rock unit. And it's a little closer view of the geology map of that area, and it truly is complex geology. But this is the area that hosts many of the deposits that are being talked about today, copper, nickel, platinum, with potential for development. And so this map then shows the drilling for the last 50 years or so. And as you can see, most of the drill holes are along that western edge of the Duluth complex. So on the southern part of the map here, it's the city of Duluth. And Ely is located towards the northern end of this map to give some reference. A little bit on the history of the Duluth complex exploration. Copper, nickel, or sulfide mineralization was originally discovered in 1948 when the Forest Service was improving one of their roads. In 1952, a company called INCO started mineral exploration in Minnesota. And in 1966, the first state mineral lease was issued for state-owned land. Then there were two exploration shafts that were sunk in Minnesota, the first in 67 and the second in 1976 by two different companies to explore their deposits at depth. There was a regional copper-nickel study that was funded by the state of Minnesota from 74 to 78. And during that time, state mineral leasing was suspended and was resumed in 1982. In 1977, DNR did a resource estimate of the known copper-nickel mineralization present in the Duluth complex, and the estimate was 4.4 billion tons of resource. Then in 1985-86, high-grade platinum values were documented in drill holes in the Duluth complex. And that was different. It was known that there was copper nickel, but not until that time was it known the extent of the platinum and palladium. And subsequent to that, a fair amount of exploration and sampling for PGEs was done. In 1993, Minnesota adopted non-ferrous metallic mineral mineland reclamation rules. And from 2000 until present, there's been active explorations by the companies listed on this chart. This shows exploration in Minnesota, exploration drilling over the last 10 years or so. And you can see 2007, 2008, there was a substantial increase in drilling in our state. And it dropped considerably in 2009 along with most commodities. And as of right now today, we have 11 drill rigs turning in Minnesota, so that exploration activity is increasing once again. This is a detailed map, and you have a larger version of that, of the Duluth complex deposits. And this map then lays out the location of those copper, nickel, platinum deposits that are known in Minnesota. And so this is that northwest portion of the Duluth complex. You see that little inset map there. And the other inset map shows the Mesabi Iron Range and the proximity or the closeness to the Duluth complex. And actually, if you look in the center of the map there, that North Shore Mining, that's North Shore's taconite pit. And so it's different geology, different rock, and the kinds of mineral deposits that are in each of them are different. And so what we have in red on this map are the known deposits of copper nickel that have been drilled out. And starting up in the upper right corner there, Franconia Minerals has a deposit called the Spruce Road, and that's very close to the surface and would potentially, it says on here, be an open pit. Next company over is Duluth Metals, and they have some underground resources that they have been exploring. Then it's Franconia Minerals, and they have the Maturi underground deposit. For a little further to the west is the Birch Lake deposit, and that's also Franconia Minerals exploration target. Then moving down, Tech Cominco, they have a deposit they call the Mesabi, and that would be a potential open pit deposit. They also have an underground resource in that deposit. The next one down is Polymet, and I'll hear about that in a minute. And you can see it, there are a number of other smaller known copper nickel resources. And also on here are shown some titanium deposits that have been drilled over the years. And I have a note on one of them in one of the coming slides. This slide is just a 3D visualization of the area that we just looked at. If you took away the overlying rocks and looked at what the copper nickel mineralization was, that's what it would look like. It follows the base of that rock unit, the Duluth complex, And it shows those same major deposits that we just went through. Just a couple of slides on U.S. metal consumption. And what does all this mean as far as what we have here in Minnesota? We have copper, cobalt, and nickel on this slide. And what we have is the amount that's mined domestically in the U.S., the amount that's recycled, and the amount that's imported. And so as you can see, if there are imports, we have the major countries where the metals are imported from on this slide. And so as you see, we mine a fair amount of copper in the U.S., about two-thirds of it. The rest is either recycled or imported. But cobalt and nickel, there are no mines at the moment for either of those in the U.S., and so they're either recycled or they're imported. Same then for platinum, palladium, and gold. The next slide, most of it is imported from the countries that you see there. There is one platinum and palladium mine in the U.S., and that's located in Stillwater, Montana. I mentioned titanium. There is a company called Cardero Iron Ore Company that is drilling today on a titaniferous magnetite, which is a titanium deposit. And they have leased a property that was drilled by U.S. Steel 40 years ago. And they believe that they have developed technology to process that material into titanium. One other exploration project I wanted to mention is in Aiken County and Carlton County. It's Rio Tinto Kennecott that is doing exploration there. They've been performing exploration for a few years, and recently they have located a fairly highly mineralized zone near Tamarack, Minnesota, and they continue their exploration efforts in that area of the state. I did want to mention that there are state-owned mineral rights, and this is where they're located. Colors just represent different funds like school trust fund or university trust fund or tax forfeit. And this is the royalty and rental revenue from those state mineral leases over the last few years. As you see, it was higher a couple years ago, and it's estimated to be down now. But most of this comes from taconite mining, and with those mines near capacity, again, that revenue should increase in the future. And this is the last slide I have, Mr. Chair. I was asked a couple of years ago what the potential economic impact to the school trust fund from these Duluth complex deposits would be. I said, I have no idea. We've never figured it out. So we went away and we did figure it out. And we have a policy fact sheet on this. And the short version is that should this material be mined in the future, then over a typical mine life of 25 or 30 years, that would represent about $1.4 billion of income to the school trust fund. And with that, Mr. Chair.
Over what period of time?
That would be over the life of mining operation, and that would be probably 20 to 30 years.
All right. Questions for Mr. Vattis? Senator Engelbrecht.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Coming from the part of the state where they grow wheat and sugar beets, I've got a question here with regards to your definitions. You have tennis, you have tons, you have short tons. Can you just give me a quick explanation of the difference between all those?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The tonnies are metric tons, and the tons are long tons, and then there are short tons. And so it's 2,000 pounds, 2,400 pounds, and how much is a metric ton? I forget. It's just a different way that people talk about the size of the deposits. In Canada, mostly it's the metric system. In the U.S., mostly it's the English system.
Have all of your tonnage estimates in your presentation been the same? Use the same units?
Mr. Chair, yes. And what we did on this map was try to represent whatever the published information was that was public. And so that's why we recorded it in that fashion.
Senator Kailash.
Mr. Chair, could you go to the next slide that has the 3D version of it? I'm just wondering if you could give me a little deeper explanation into the geology of some of this. It's right after the map. That one, yep. It's hard to read on here, so. But you've got the Duluth area, you've got something called a trough, and then you've got a bald eagle something.
Mr. Chair, what we're looking at is several units within the Duluth complex.
Okay.
There are multiple intrusions that make up the Duluth complex, and it really started out as molten rock and tried to rise to the surface but never made it in most cases and solidified. And so the bald eagle intrusion is one separate, discrete intrusion.
Excuse me, I'm not a miner.
Oh, I'm sorry.
What's the intrusion?
It's called the bald eagle intrusion. It's just a slightly different variation of that same Duluth complex type material.
Okay.
Each of these intrusions has a little different composition.
Okay.
So maybe I shouldn't have shown this one.
Well, no, that's okay. Part of it is that, it's blue, so I don't know if that's an aquifer or what. That's part of my question for that. Those are some of the, if
Mr.
you're doing
Chair,
3D, that's one of the concerns. So
the colors here would represent those areas of the bedrock that contain copper and nickel mineral resource.
Okay.
And so what we're showing in kind of the gray there is the rock underlying that, which would be probably aconite or another rock unit called the Virginia Formation. And these deposits occur, as you can see here, right along the contact between those two geologic units. And I guess it's significant in that explaining why some of these deposits likely be mined underground or would have to be mined underground. They're much deeper from the surface, while others could potentially be mined by open pit methods.
Okay. Thank you.
How far, in an open pit situation, how far would one typically have to go down for these deposits?
Mr. Chair, I think maybe the polyment might be able to explain that. Hundreds of feet would be very normal. An economic depth where it's no longer economic to go down in an open pit because you have to remove so much waste material. And so that would vary from one deposit to another on what the grade of the material is and also how deeply it's buried.
Thank you. Someone else, Senator Dill.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Vadas, on that core sample that you passed around, I believe it said 2.3% gold. Is that what it said? Or 2.3 or 0.02?
Mr. Chair, it has about a quarter of an ounce of gold in it, but also 2.3 ounces of silver. So there's gold and silver.
Okay, so those numbers on there are ounces.
Yes. And it also has 4.1% zinc.
Well, is that good or is that, what does that mean?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dill, if there was enough quantity of this material, it would very likely be considered ore. The problem with this particular zone is it's very narrow and very small, and so there's not enough quantity to really justify any sort of a mining operation. So it's just an example of what that geology might hold.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Stump.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There is one other mining operation that university was doing some experiment in up in Kitson County, and it had to do with clay. And they had used it in for a number of different purposes, insulation, and I don't see that on any of your information.
Mr. Vadas.
Mr. Chair, Senator Stumpf, to my knowledge, that never became a commercial operation. I think the university was doing some research, and you're right, it was a unique clay where if you heated it up, it made an insulating type material. Also has been used for potentially for, it's called ball clay, which is China clay. And to my knowledge, there was really never a commercial operation that resulted from that.
Okay. Senator Frederickson.
Mr. Chairman, since Senator Stump talked about clay, I was going to say just a sentence or two about kaolin clay that Mr. Vadas mentioned in Minnesota River Valley. It's near Senator Sharon and my district. But kaolin clay has a number of uses. The lowest use is making cement. There's been a lot of exploration going on in the Minnesota River area to try and locate a larger vein of higher quality kaolin. And the higher quality kaolin is used for coating the very expensive papers that we see in very high-end publications. It's also used in pharmaceuticals. There's been a lot of exploration going on. The companies do not share the information they found, but they're looking for a larger quantity of kaolin clay that might be used in the higher end of products.
Mr. Vadas? So
that might be something develops in the future, but now there's quite a bit of kaolin clay mined for brick and also cement.
Mr. Vadas?
Mr. Chair, that's absolutely right. Most of the kaolin clay that's used for that high-quality coating comes from Georgia, and there's been a steady interest over the last 20 or 30 years to look at the Minnesota deposits and figure out if they can be upgraded and used for that purpose. But to this time, no paper-quality kaolin has been developed here in the state yet.
Ms. Lepacco. Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. I saw the Kim and thought it. Sorry. Senator Saxog?
Mr. Vadas, before you leave, we were kind of talking, we got the big picture on mining in Minnesota and, in fact, mining in the world. And I'm not sure that we kind of heard the answer to why all of a sudden Minnesota is getting all this attention. Is it... Is it because our environmental standards are so low, or it's easy to get to, or what's the?
Senator Saxog, that's a great question. Why now? If this has always been here,
Mr. Chair, Senator Saxog, these deposits have been explored over the last 40 years or so, and there have been periods in the past when it looked like someone was going to propose development. Probably the most recent was in the late 70s, 1980. Company named AMAX was going to move forward, the price dropped at the time, and so that project did not move forward. But there are some differences today for these low-grade copper-nickel deposits that are different than they were at that time. One is that the recognition of the amount of platinum and palladium in these deposits is far greater. Today, that represents about one-third of the value of most of these deposits, where before it was only looking at the copper and nickel. And one other factor that has made a difference is how you process this ore. In the past, it would have gone to a smelter. Not to get in too much detail, these concentrates from Minnesota are very difficult to smelt because it's hard to remove the copper from the nickel. And the difference that has come up in recent years is something called a hydrometallurgy, which is a whole different process to extract the copper and nickel. It's not a smelter. The minerals are put into a solution and recovered from that solution. It's much less polluting than a smelter would be, and also it's much cheaper than a smelter. And so there's just been this technological advance along with recognition of the platinum and palladium, in my opinion, that's made some difference in how people are viewing the deposits we have in Minnesota and what their potential is. As far as the nickel, about 95% of all the known nickel resources in the United States are contained in the Duluth complex. There are very few places around the U.S. where there are known drilled-out nickel resources. So on a national level, this is a potential of significant resource for the U.S.
But it was not discovered or accessible until this hydrological metallurgy process was developed.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. In my opinion, that made a big difference in really the value of these deposits, the problems of trying to recover the metals through this smelter process and all the issues that come along with smelters, the sulfur dioxide and some of those things, and the economics of recovery are different.
Thank you. Mr. Lapico, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
You can certainly, do you want to, would it be easier to sit where Mr. Vadas is sitting or switch?
Well, it's fine.
Whichever you prefer.
I think this will work well.
Great.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Just make sure the microphone is somewhat closer to you so we can hear you.
Now I get to see it.
Okay, please let me know if I'm not projecting adequately.
A little closer. Thank you.
I'd like to present a bit of information on research that's been conducted at the Department of Natural Resources regarding the Duluth Complex rock and water quality. We have looked at other rocks, but given a relatively short period of time, I've decided to focus on the Duluth Complex and also strictly a few aspects of the research on the Duluth Complex rock.
If you wouldn't mind introducing yourself to the committee, I'd appreciate it.
Okay. My name is Kim Lapaco. I'm a principal engineer at the Department of Natural Resources, Division of Lands and Minerals.
Thank you.
I want to start out just with some introductory information to see if we can get people to some degree on the same playing field, the same level. The question is, what are the major drainage quality concerns regarding mining wastes? And mining waste can cover fairly large areas, as can be seen by the stockpiles and the tailings basin depicted on the bottom of the slide. And the main concern is acidic drainage or acid mine drainage, acid rock drainage. Secondarily, there can be neutral pH drainage with elevated concentrations of heavy metals. And finally, there are other concerns, but acidic drainage with high metals and neutral drainage with elevated heavy metals are the main concerns. Now, some mining wastes do not have water quality problems. Other mining wastes do. And the range of water quality associated with mine waste can be quite large. For example, on the Iron Range, there are several towns that have their water supplies in open pits, which suggests that the water quality is fairly good. There are other examples on the other extreme of things, and these can't be ignored. For example, the Berkeley Pit in Butte, Montana. And this is one of the classic bad examples of water quality, and it's a place where researchers like to go. It's one of the meccas that you have to visit. And this pit is fairly large, about a mile by 1.5 miles by 0.3 miles deep, 40 billion gallons of water. pH is about 2.7, and that's quite acidic. Copper concentrations, 190 milligrams per liter, very high. Zinc concentrations, 620 milligrams per liter, very high. You know, perhaps three orders of magnitude higher than toxic level for human beings. So we can have, on one hand, good water quality associated with drinking water on the Iron Range, or quite bad water quality, in this case, in the Berkeley Pit.
So, Senator Frederickson.
Mr. Chairman, Lapaco, from what type of mining did the Berkeley Pit receive that water?
It is a metal mine, not an iron mine. There's sulfides associated with it, and I'll get into that further as we move along.
What type of mine did you say?
It is was a metal mine. I'm not sure exactly what the predominant metal was, but copper, I believe.
Okay. All right.
And so why does the water quality vary? That's the question that was posed back in the 70s when the copper-nickel study was initiated. And what variables influence this reaction? In other words, how do we tell what we're going to have, as was indicated by the questions regarding the type of mine in Montana? And so the DNR started researching in a number of different areas, and this is meant to summarize very briefly the work that we've done over the course of the past about 33 years. There were initially there were some test piles run that were up near the Babbitt area, six test piles that ran from 1977 to 1993. We started doing some work on the South Quishwe intrusion. This is a specific intrusion of the Duluth complex that's associated with the Duncan mine. So we had got 23 rocks from there because they were available and conducted laboratory studies. We did a study on particle size, the influence of particle size on water quality that started in 1993 and is running yet. One tailing sample that was generated during recent exploration and pilot testing by Tech Cominco, which started in about 2002. 10 rocks from the Partridge River intrusion, which is another one of these intrusions. It's the intrusion where the PolyMet operation is located and the Tech Cominco properties are located. We did some work on ASTM test verification. This is a laboratory test, so it's one Duluth complex sample. We did some mitigation studies, and the green bars refer to those. Adding alkaline solids to neutralize acids. That a study ran from 1988 through the present. Subaqueous disposal, underwater disposal, and I'll have a couple of slides on that later on. Ran some column tests, and we also did some field tests on subaqueous disposal. And all these tests ran for, you know, a number of years. As a matter of fact, the second yellow line is a 20-year study that's still in progress. Now, the key variable here, and the people that have alluded to, or the key reaction, the people that have asked, what kind of mine is it? And this particular reaction, which I can render down to ordinary English, is the reaction that's most that's the focus of water quality problems regarding acidic drainage, and also very closely related to release of heavy metals. In this reaction, the first term is FES, or an iron sulfide, that reacts with oxygen, O2, and water, and it produces 2H pluses. Acid is the H plus, SO4 sulfate, and the FeOH3 is rust. So what we have are three ingredients that make this thing go: iron sulfide, or the sulfide mineral, oxygen, and water. If I take any one of those three away, the reaction stops. If we get rid of this iron sulfide, we don't have a problem, no acid produced. If we get rid of the oxygen, we don't have any acid produced. And if we don't have any water, we don't have any acid produced. And this is a photograph of a Duluth complex drill core piece. And it shows the sulfide minerals are the shiny ones, the ones that our eyes would probably be drawn to if we were looking at it. They're metallic looking. The bulk of the rock, however, is silicate minerals. Plagioclase and olivine are two predominant silicate minerals. They react to neutralize acid, although they dissolve very slowly. And there are also oxide minerals in the Duluth complex as well. So there's Duluth complex that has more sulfides, Duluth complex that has less sulfides or virtually no sulfides. But this gives a reasonable example of Duluth complex rock that might be associated with a copper nickel type mine. So one of the key objectives of the research, we can see that we have some iron sulfides present, or sulfide minerals, and we could have more or less. One key question is, well, how does pH vary as a function of sulfur content? And we, how much sulfides are necessary before we get a problematic situation? And we have laboratory experiments and field tests that were conducted to address that. Those were enumerated in a little bit of detail earlier. So this is the type of work that's done with laboratory testing. Each of these little columns has a rock sample in it, and they're subjected to rinsing every week, and then we collect the water that comes through the rock and analyze it for its constituents. And what we found out that affecting drainage pH is not only the sulfide content of the rock, but also the time of dissolution. And I'm going to show in the next slide a plot of pH versus time for three of the different samples. These are samples that ran for about 13 years. On the y-axis, or the vertical axis, is drainage pH, and on the x-axis is time in years. And you can see by the change in concentrations or change in pH that the time of these reactions are slow. The evolution of the reaction is slow. This is not something you're going to run in your chemistry lab in Chem 1001, because it takes a long time for the water quality to manifest itself. This low sulfur rock, 0.18% sulfur, is reaching its minimum after about 8 years, and that minimum is still above pH 6, which is a typical water quality standard. Now, the next two have higher sulfur contents, 0.58% and 1.44%. And in these cases also, there's a variation with time, and that variation in this case going down, reaching a minimum somewhere around maybe year 7 or 6 or so, and likewise this sample reaching a minimum around year 6 to 7. So the time of reaction is important variable, as is the sulfur content, which was the main focus of the question. So we have 0.18, looks like it's keeping above the water quality standard. In other words, it would meet standards. The 0.58 gets down to about pH 4, which is well below the standard. And the 1.4% sulfur gets down to pH 3. And so I just want to point out, for those that are less familiar with the pH scale, one unit of change reflects a factor of 10 concentration in acid. So at pH 3, we have 10 to the third, or 1,000 times as much H plus in solution as pH 6. So this is a far worse situation than we have up here. It's not just a matter of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Do you surmise, Mr. Lopaco, that with that information, that the water quality issue is of most concern in that timeline of, say, 4 to 15 years?
It would depend actually on the sulfur content. Sometimes there's a more rapid reaction, but I guess the main point here is that we have to be cognizant of the fact that there is a longer time associated with the evolution than typical reactions that we're used to looking at. Whereas we might run a test for 24 hours or a week and say, well, that's pretty good.
Okay.
This is something that's longer and evolving.
Okay. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just going back to that, what is the sulfur content of most of the ore in Minnesota?
Lopaco.
A sulfur content of most of the ore?
Of the ore in Minnesota. I mean, what percent would it fall into of those different samples? You know?
Okay, I don't think I could address that. Perhaps the people from PolyMet will be able to address that more accurately. And I'd just like to point out also that sometimes the ore will be processed in a manner such that much of the sulfur is removed, because that's where the economic values are. And in the hydrometallurgical process, the sulfur is also used to produce acid that's needed in the process, and that reduces the amount of sulfide in the remnant tailings. So we've got waste rock that's on the surface, and we certainly want to know what the sulfur content of that is. And the ore is a little bit different situation, where much of the sulfur would be removed.
Thank you.
Okay, so why did the pH increase here? We, by calculation, we could tell that it wasn't all gone, and so we had access to what's an electron microscope, not at the DNR, but outside, and we had a photograph made of one of the sulfide grains that are present, and the sulfide is the brighter material that's present in large amounts towards the core of this grain. And this size here is 0.04 millimeters, 40 microns, so this grain is it's rather small. But what this told us is that the rust, that's the reaction product of the iron sulfide oxidation, was being deposited on the edge of this grain. And so after 328 weeks when we collected this sample, there was a substantial sulfide rind accumulated around the edge of the solid, around the grain. So 328 weeks here it's about 6 years, so it's right around the time that pH has bottomed out and is starting to increase. And so what that's associated with is a coating that's forming on the sulfide minerals. So that just lends us a bit of insight, and that iron oxide coating inhibits the oxygen access. Remember, we need the sulfide, oxygen, and water, so it's limiting the oxygen access to the iron sulfide in the middle, and therefore slowing the rate of reaction. Our laboratory results from all of our samples, I've got plotted here the minimum pH observed in the laboratory versus sulfur content. So going back to this question of, well, how much sulfur is needed before we start getting problematic situations? These two points should be above. This was a sporadic point that fell below 6. And these two samples were generally above 6. But we can see a trend as sulfur content increased, the pH decreased, which is exactly what one would expect to happen. And this is based on laboratory tests conducted for 6 years to 15 years roughly. Now, what does that mean in the field? You know, the laboratory tests are good. They give us a lot of information on a number of different samples, but we also had this, as mentioned earlier, some field tests on Duluth complex rock, roughly 1,000 tons each, monitored for a period of 16 years for water quality and water quantity that was coming off those. And we could look at the test piles, which are shown in red, and superimpose those on the figure of lab data, and we said, well, we got a fairly good agreement. Now, part of that is fortuitous, but it does suggest that the laboratory data is fairly reasonable. It's not way off. And so that was very helpful with regards to the laboratory verification results of those laboratory results based on field water quality. So I guess just to point out here, this is the key point. pH, minimum pH goes down, meaning more acidic sulfur content goes up. We've got some ideas to what that relationship is. That's an important thing to have access to. Now, the question of metal release, heavy metals, a lot of the talk focuses on acid, but heavy metals is a second issue that's certainly of environmental importance. And as pH decreases, metal concentrations will increase. And the field data that we have shows this pretty dramatically. This is data from the test piles. Drainage pH is along the bottom, so more acidic is over to the left, the lower pH values, and nickel concentration is plotted on the vertical axis. As you can see, as we get down to 5 and 4 and 3, these metal concentrations just skyrocket. So it points out that with acidic drainage, we've got a double problem. The acid itself is a toxic issue, and the metals are a second issue. Now, up here in the circumneutral pH range, or around neutral pH, metal concentrations are fairly low. Nonetheless, there is concern in that lower pH range, although nothing like the levels. We're up to 600 or 800 milligrams per liter. In the neutral pH range, we're talking about 0.08 milligrams per liter in the nickel plot above. But there's a peak that occurs with pH decreasing down at below about 6.8. So there is a dependence also in this circumneutral pH range that indicates that metals can increase even in the neutral pH range, and that's something that we have to be cognizant of.
And this is all examination of what you found in the laboratory, as well as some what exactly in the field did you study that gives you these answers?
Okay, this is from the test piles, the six test piles of about 1,000 tons that were studied from 1976 to 1993.
Okay.
And so
these are past tailing piles?
Waste rock. They were called waste rock piles. By today's standards, they might actually be ore.
Okay.
Okay, so we recognized that there are our water quality problems. So parallel with our dissolution studies, we also looked at certain methods of mitigation. And there's several of these listed. We can certainly treat water. That's something that's done. Active treatment, for example, a lime treatment plant where drainage is neutralized in an engineered plant. Passive treatment, sulfate-reducing systems that reverse the oxidation reaction. We can add alkaline materials, as I mentioned earlier. Dry covers can be placed on top, for example, synthetic materials like a plastic or a rubber material that could keep water out, thereby eliminating one of the three critical pieces of the iron sulfide oxidation reaction. And subaqueous disposal, underwater disposal, is another means of mitigation that's the preferred alternative in Canada and also in Australia, and it makes sense, even though at first glance it seems rather counterintuitive. Why would you place a potential water quality problem underwater? Well, by putting it underwater, you eliminate the air component of the reaction. And the best analog I can think of is the Lake Superior situation, where old logs were recovered sometime after 2000. I don't recall exactly when. But these old timbers were in fantastic shape, despite the fact that they'd been underwater for 100 years or so. And so they weren't allowed to oxidize or rot. And so the similar thing happens with underwater disposal. And a parallel to that is wetlands over tailings, and those are in blue because I'll just give you a brief glance at what we've done there. And also placing coatings on solid is something that we've examined in the laboratory. This is our subaqueous disposal field tanks, a number of tanks that are at our Hibbing research site that have water and Duluth complex rock in them. This is the alternative, the sub-aerial or on-land disposal. So those are the two situations we would be considering, and the next slide gives an example of how that performs. This is a disposal of 0.66% sulfur Duluth complex rock. The earlier results would indicate that that should produce acids, and the pH versus time plot bears that out. The on-land disposal produces pHs that go down towards 4, and that's fairly consistent with what we saw in the laboratory. But in the subaqueous situation, we see the pHs that are maintained above 7, and that's over the period of about, 5-6 years. And so that's a very sound method. It bears out the physics of oxygen diffusion. It bears out what the Canadians have supported and suggests that the subaqueous disposal is a good way of disposing things.
Does it take into account, does it take into account hydrology? The potential of that water to escape?
These experiments, the mechanism that they're focusing on is how fast can oxygen diffuse through the water. So in this case, we actually have sort of a worse case because we've captured the water in the tank. It's not allowed to move out. And I guess the second point is that if you're limiting the reaction, that's limiting the amount of contaminants that could be generated and move out. These experiments don't simulate water moving in the same manner as it would in a groundwater system, though.
Well,
Senator,
yes.
What would you expect to happen if there was more fresh water introduced or moving through those subaqueous tanks? And would you expect it to the water quality improve or decrease?
Or if the water was agitated and somehow oxygen got into it.
The agitation would increase the amount of the oxygen transport below. These systems are fairly quiet, and therefore there's just diffusion. If you were to agitate the system, that would increase the amount of oxygen transport down to the solids. And a somewhat parallel situation was the development of wetlands on top of tailings. So it's a similar idea, keeping water on top and adding vegetation to further remove oxygen from the system and remove one of the three components for that sulfide oxidation reaction. And so to wrap up, drainage pH was affected by both the time of dissolution and the sulfide content. There are other variables that would affect it, but I won't go into those. Those are two critical variables. Trace metals can be elevated at circumneutral pH, but they're much lower than what would be expected at an acidic pH, a low pH. And then subaqueous disposal of mine waste produced an elevated pH, and I didn't show this result. But in the tailings experiment, wetlands on tailings, the metal concentrations were about 1/10,000th to 1/100th that which was produced on land disposal. Okay, so if there are questions, I'd be happy to take those.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I'm trying to picture how this would work. If you put tailings into a mine pit and it gradually filled up with water, I mean, the oxidation would happen at the beginning of the process, right? So putting it underwater wouldn't reverse that, would it, if it happened? I mean, once you have the reaction,
you are absolutely right.
Okay.
Very good.
Tobacco.
You're hired.
Yes.
So for the benefit, would you repeat understanding of what Senator Anderson said?
The question was, well, if you disposed of tailings in a pit that didn't have water and then the water table was allowed to rise, there would be oxidation. The situation that would occur, there would be oxidation prior to submersion of the tailings, so they would generate acid and release reaction products. And once the water came up, some fraction of that acid and reaction products could be released to the water column.
So that once the acid is formed, it can't be broken up by the water.
That's correct. It could be neutralized by other components that are present, but, for example, if there's alkalinity in the water that's coming into the pit or there is limestone in the tailings, that could neutralize some of the acid. But lacking those sources of neutralization, the acid or metals would be added to the water column.
In your studies of these methods of mitigation, did you have any context for them? For example, were any of these methods, were you able to refer to any of these methods that may have been used at some point in time, actually in mining operations?
We were, with regards to the subaqueous disposal, the underwater disposal has been applied in a number of cases, and that is an important aspect to any of the laboratory-type studies or even small-scale field studies, is to have an example as to empirical examples as to how they perform on field scale.
And you said that it was used in Canada.
Yes, and it's also used in Wisconsin at the Flambeau mine.
Okay. And the wetlands over tailings, has that been used?
It's been used in Canada.
Okay. Did you study the results of, did you compare the results of some of these methods used in Canada versus your own results?
This was done with regards to the underwater disposal, but it was done largely based on comparison with the physics of oxygen diffusion rather than another site. I think that in general we can see similar results with other sites, but there might be site-specific differences that would have to be taken into account.
So you don't know that the Canadian model resulted in such high pH levels when they were underwater, as you found in your experiments?
They might have. I know in one case they did put in mine waste that had been oxidized, so they had the problem of releasing some of the reaction products that were generated. But in some cases, they have cases where the pH is elevated. Whether it's precisely to the same degree, I don't recall now.
All right. Thank you. Senator Anderson?
Mr. Chair, are there any mining? I mean, it seems like it would be hard during the mining process itself, before you dispose of it, to keep the ore, you know, from either contact with any air or contact with any water. I mean, isn't that sort of part of any mining operation, that both of those things, that the ore would be exposed to that at some point? Or is it possible to maintain separation all through the process until it's time to dispose of it?
Mr. Lepeco.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. It would be, if it's a conceptual question, and once again, I'll say it's good to remember that the ore is going to be processed, but the waste rock and the tailings are the components that are going to be left out for eternity. And it's possible that, let's just say that there was an open pit that was full of water, that when waste rock was generated, it could be taken there and plunked into a pit full of water and placed underwater. But more likely is the situation that you're envisioning, where it would be placed on the land surface for some time before it was placed underwater. And if that were the case, there would have to be a provision for any contaminant release that was unacceptable in the water column. In other words, for example, it would have to be treated until it was acceptable, and then once clean, that reaction rate, that subaqueous disposal environment should maintain water at an acceptable level.
Okay. Other questions? Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Lepeco, if I've got that right. In the proposals in Minnesota for non-ferrous mining, is cyanide going to be used to process the ore, to pull out gold or whatever?
Mr. Lepeco.
Mr. Chairman,
And if so, does that present any disposal issue?
I will ask the people from PolyMet to address that, and I have not seen any case where that would be used. So as far as I know, it's not a chemical that's used in the processing, and the people at PolyMet are saying no.
Thank you very much. Steve Colvin.
Thank you.
sit over here. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Stephen Colvin. I supervise environmental review for Department of Natural Resources and work in the Division of Ecological Resources. And we're going to take a bit of an abrupt turn here from Kim's discussion of waste characterization, and I've been asked to give an overview on environmental review. And I should say before I move into the talk, most of our mining project environmental reviews, and PolyMet specifically, is a joint state-federal environmental review process. My talk really focuses mostly on the state process, though I do have a couple of slides on the federal process, and I'll interject some comments in betwixt and between.
Thank you, and I appreciate this because this is a very, very critical to our knowledge of the whole process.
Okay. So I have a couple of purposes. One is just a basic description of the environmental review process as it operates in the state, as I said. The other is to describe it a little bit more how it operates with mining specifically. And a couple of key messages I want to bring out. Environmental review and permitting are different. That's especially true in the state process. That's one of these federal-state differences I'll get to a little later. The other is that is just that. The Minnesota Environmental Policy Act, that's MEPA, and the National Environmental Policy Act, that's NEPA, have some important differences as we move through an environmental impact statement. So a little bit of background. Environmental review is usually done, is to be done, on projects that may have the potential for significant environmental effects. Environmental review can be mandatory or discretionary. In the state, we have different sorts of thresholds and rule. We have thresholds for very small projects that projects below those thresholds are specifically exempt from environmental review. We have mandatory thresholds for something called environmental assessment worksheet. And projects that are bigger than the exemption and smaller than the mandatory threshold for an environmental assessment worksheet are subject to discretionary environmental review. So if there's something particular about that project that's unusual, it may trigger environmental review. And then there are also mandatory thresholds for environmental impact statements. The purpose of environmental review is to disclose information. It's meant to be a systematic public process, and it works in conjunction with permits and approvals, though it is not a permit or an approval itself. I mentioned the authorities in the state. The main laws governing environmental review are the Minnesota Environmental Policy Act. That's Minnesota Statutes Chapter 116D. And the implementing rules are Chapter 4410, the EQB rules. And then federally, it's National Policy Act, and National Environmental Policy Act, excuse me, and then its implementing rules. And the citation there is actually for NEPA, not for the and I should say there are a whole series of different federal rules. There's a general federal rule that applies. It's done by the Council on Environmental Quality, the federal equivalent of the Environmental Quality Board, and that deals generally with the rules and regulations concerning federal environmental review. But in addition, each of the federal agencies has its own set of rules and procedures for federal environmental review. So it's a much more complex sort of body of law. Responsible government unit is a term in state environmental review. That's the entity that writes an EAW or writes an EIS. How a government unit gets assigned to be an RGU for a particular sort of project proposal is established in rule. I did want to point out a proposer, if a government entity, can be an RGU. Just to give you a case in point from today, in today's EQB Monitor, the Department of Natural Resources published an environmental assessment worksheet for which we're RGU. For the Vermilion Stream Restoration Project, which is also a department project. That's actually fairly common in state law. It's also fairly common federally. The RGU receives information from a proposer. They decide if environmental assessment worksheets or environmental impact statements are needed. They actually write the EAW or EIS based on information provided. They evaluate information received, including public comments, and then decide if it's an EAW, the end of the process is to decide if an environmental impact statement is needed. For an EIS, the end of the process is to decide if the environmental impact statement you did was adequate. Proposer also has a role in environmental review. One is they must provide a thorough project description so that the RGU can know what they're doing well enough to identify potential environmental impacts and decide what sorts of things should be evaluated. The proposer also identifies and applies for permits and approvals that they're going to need in conjunction with their project. They provide data. They conduct studies to deliver information to the responsible governmental unit. And in the case of an environmental impact statement, they pay for its preparation. I've already mentioned a couple of times the different types of reviews. So I'll skip just to the bottom of the slide. In the state process, there's an environmental assessment worksheet and an environmental impact statement. The federal equivalent of the environmental assessment worksheet is called an environmental assessment, or EA. We won't talk about that further today since we've been working on joint EISs with the Corps to date. The environmental assessment worksheet, or EAW, is got 30 standard questions on it currently. That works out to be 30 pages before it's filled in with data. It includes the project description, a list of the permits that are needed, project setting, potential impacts in various sorts of resource areas, and mitigation measures. It's meant to be a reasonably brief disclosure of information, and to decide if an environmental impact statement is needed. The project proposer supplies the data, and then the RGU prepares and approves the EAW. Another place where an EAW form is used is in the scoping process for an environmental impact statement. And there, the structure of the EAW, or the content of the EAW, is somewhat different. For areas that are going to be studied thoroughly, at least in the EIS, the scoping EAW will identify that that's going to be in scope and what sorts of things are likely to be studied, rather than actually present the content there. Environmental impact statement is a detailed analysis of project impacts. That said, in state law, it is to be analytical and not encyclopedic. Provides a project description. We have to consider alternatives in an environmental impact statement, including a build and a no build or no action alternative, alternative sites, alternative scales, technologies, and modified designs. In addition to environmental effects, it also compares economic and social impacts and identifies mitigation of potential impacts.
What does no build mean? Build, no build mean?
No action alternative is what I'd actually prefer to call it. It's what would happen if the project wasn't built, if the proposed project wasn't built. Okay. What would the environment look like?
Meaning it might look the same.
It might, although I've seen instances where the environment's going to undergo certain changes regardless of whether the project's built or not, and so those get described.
Okay.
The steps in the EA...
Question on that. Identifies mitigation of potential impacts.
Mm-hmm.
How is... What are some examples of that? Maybe you could confine it to the mining arena.
With mining, you might look at some process modifications to, say, reduce emissions of, say, some air quality constituents or some water quality parameters. You might look at treatment for water some water quality issues. You might look at, wetlands mitigation would be pretty standard. With mining projects, particularly the metallic mineral mining projects, you've got a lot of wetland loss, so there's mitigation associated with that. So that's just a few examples.
Mr. Chair?
Is it all technically oriented mitigation? Meaning some engineering process?
For the most part, I'd say. Well,
maybe it's something.
You know, something's not coming to mind exactly right now of something that might be an administrative mitigation.
Okay. All right.
I'm not precluding that, but.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as you, and I'm assuming you're taking us kind of through the steps in chronological order that may occur, but does the proposer then at some point have an opportunity to change the project as you identify some things that may not, that may hold the project back? I mean, is there constant changing going on at this process?
Mr. Colvin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, yes, absolutely. We do see a fair amount of our experience has been with larger, more complex projects, whether in an EIS or in an EAW. It's not at all unusual to see several project modifications on the as you proceed from the initial data submittal through to the final EIS adequacy or the record of decision on the EAW.
What about post-EIS?
Mr. Chair, you can see those. If a change occurs to the project after the EIS adequacy determination, if it's a significant change, if it's a change that appears as though it may significantly change, say, the impact profile of the project, then under state law they would be required to prepare an EIS supplement. Technically, that's where we're at with the SR project. We will be preparing an EIS supplement for them because they increased the indurating furnace and some other aspects of their project.
So all mitigation activities or alternatives that are considered are done at the environmental impact statement stage, or can they also be done as part of the permit?
Mr. Chair, they certainly can be done as part of the permit. And often are. In the state process, there's a fair amount of work to do after the EIS and before the permits are generally issued. Those additional mitigations would typically reduce the impact profile, and so those sorts of mitigations wouldn't be likely to trigger supplemental environmental review in most instances. If we're seeing something that we think may, we're generally trying to let the proposer know about that right away so that they can choose to have that incorporated in the EIS as we move along.
Is the attempt, however, to try and encompass as much of the project's environmental impacts and mitigation and what you're going to do about it all within the EIS? Maybe it's not formal or required by law, but is that the agency practice to try and get it all in there?
Mr. Chair, I'd say the agency's practice and the agency's goal is to get a pretty thorough description of the impacts and alternatives. In terms of the details related to mitigation for permitting, I would say no. some of those details become dependent on very specific design features that occur after environmental review and are more in the permitting realm. So we try to identify some of the obvious and important mitigations, but we're not trying to identify all of them at this stage.
Thank you.
Okay. Little bit about the environmental impact statement process steps. State process starts with a very formal scoping process. I mentioned that we use the environmental assessment worksheet to do that. The scoping EAW is released for public review with a draft scoping decision document. We conduct a public meeting. It's out for a public comment period. At the completion of the public comment period, the RGU decides on what the scope of the EIS is going to be and issues a final scoping decision. The next thing we do is to publish the EIS preparation notice, and you'll see something here about a 280-day clock. In rule, state EISs are to adhere more or less to a 280-day period from the date of the EIS prep notice to the date of the adequacy determination. On the other hand, an EIS, once you get to the end of the process, the final EIS has to be adequate, and that sometimes, and with large complex projects often, requires quite a bit more data, quite a bit more analysis, and quite a bit more time than can be encompassed in this. And the environmental review rules allow for discussing extensions of that time frame with the project proposer. So
help us understand where the PolyMet project is in that slide.
280 days is what, about three quarters of a year? And we did, I'm forgetting when we did the EIS preparation notice. That was scoping decision. Was that the prep notice, or was prep notice 2007? In any event, it's well beyond the 280 days. At least a couple years.
Okay. And then we are now in the draft EIS.
We're actually past that.
Okay.
We have prepared the draft EIS, and the draft EIS includes the proposer developing a lot of data and a lot of reports. And I should say the reports are identified in the scoping EAW and scoping decision documents. And our agency hires a third-party contractor typically to actually take this information and write the draft EIS. Draft EIS is published and for a comment period of varying length. Sometime during that open comment period, we conduct a public meeting. Once the comment period closes, the responsible government unit carefully reviews the information obtained during the comment period, decides what modifications are required, and sets about, if we have to acquire new information or new analyses, doing those or working with the proposer to obtain those, modifying the environmental impact statement to reflect the additional information. And that culminates in the publication of the final EIS. And the final EIS will also contain responses to the public comments on the draft EIS. And that's not a one-for-one. In the case like this EIS where we got thousands of comments, we'll group them because we have many similar comments, and so we'll just respond once to that particular type of comment. The public comment period on the final EIS is short. It's only 10 days. And technically, it's not on the content of the final EIS, but rather on whether the EIS is adequate. The RGU, or in some instances, the Environmental Quality Board will make an EIS adequacy determination at least 10 days after publication of the final EIS. And that and that's a determination of whether the EIS adequately studied the things it said it was going to in the scoping decision document, and whether it fully complied with Minnesota's environmental review rules. It's not a it's not a finding on the project itself. And then after that, state environmental review is complete, and the project proceeds to permits and other decisions.
So that in this matter, would you mind go back once? Yep. And thank you. In this matter, it would be the DNR who determines the adequacy of the final EIS.
That's after. Correct.
Okay. But that's then correct. After that, then there are other permits and decisions to be had as well.
That's also correct.
Based on other areas of statute?
Yes.
And rule?
Yes. Yes. State and federal and some local.
Okay. I'm sorry, who had their hand up? Senator Anderson.
I'm trying to fit the EPA in here. So when do they make a, I mean, they sent you a letter saying it's not adequate. Where does that fit on this?
Oh, okay.
Mr. Colvin.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'll go back to the map here. The Environmental Protection Agency is not reviewing this. The process steps are really kind of mapped after the state process, but the general tracking of the federal process is similar. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has been reviewing or offered opportunities to review, and has been reviewing proposer data reports, preliminary drafts of chapters, and that sort of thing prepared by the third-party contractor kind of through the past several years. Their actual comment letter to which you refer came in as a public comment. Now, EPA has two roles in the federal process. One role is to provide technical comments like any other public reviewer might, but another is to review environmental impact statements for their compliance with federal regulations. And so that's also a piece of EPA's role. So that they're kind of serving as a surrogate for the Council on Environmental Quality in that regard. So their letter had both.
So they issued a statement as part of the public comments of the draft EIS.
That's correct.
Would you expect them to provide public comment on the adequacy of the EIS, or do you think their statement covers both?
Well, that's where Mr. Chair, that's where the end game differs a little bit for the federal and state processes. The state process ends in an adequacy determination on the need for adequacy determination on the EIS. The federal process ends with a record of decision, which in the case of the PolyMet project will be a regulatory decision on their wetlands permit. So that actually is an approval. And
from the EPA or the Army?
No, the Army is the responsible government unit. However, the EPA will review and score the final EIS substantively, just as they did the draft EIS.
As part of the comment on adequacy?
In the federal process, it's not a comment on adequacy. It's actually a substantive review, and they have a 30-day period rather than a 10-day.
All right. So that will be part of the EPA will once again weigh in some way.
Yes.
During the permits and decisions phase.
Yes.
That you've described. Okay.
Yes.
As will the Army Corps of Engineers.
They are the permit decision maker for federal wetlands jurisdiction.
In that area.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a follow-up?
Can I just follow up, Mr. Chair? So in the end, does the EPA have any decision-making authority on this?
Mr. Chair, Senator, in addition to their NEPA-related authority, they do also have some authority, elevation authority, under the Clean Water Act over the wetlands permitting. I am not an expert on that area, but the short answer is yes, they do have some sort of authority with respect to wetlands permitting over the Corps.
Senator Saxog.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Colvin, I'm just trying to put the whole process in some type of perspective here. How would you characterize the rigor with which we deal in an EAW and an EIS and eventually the permitting, say, compared with other states or even other countries?
Mr. Colvin.
Mr. Chair, Senator, varies quite a bit. On mining, I don't have enough. I would be unwilling to speak specifically of mining. I haven't been in the mining specific environmental review long enough, but generally in environmental review, the states are quite variable in their environmental review processes. Some states don't have state specific environmental review. Some states have considerably less permitting than we do. Other states have environmental review that's comparably rigorous to ours, and I would suspect regulatory frameworks that are comparably rigorous. So it's really quite variable in that regard.
Follow up?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Colvin, I'm just trying to figure. So what you're saying is that we have a good and a thorough process.
Mr. Colvin.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I certainly would like to think that we do. Yes.
Well, isn't it true that Minnesota invented environmental review?
Mr. Chair, I'm not certain. I think I do know that NEPA, the National Act, was written in 69. The State Act was 73. I don't know the history before that.
I thought I read somewhere that we were the first state to begin any type of environmental review process, even before the federal legislation. But I could be wrong.
Okay.
Senator Saxon.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Colvin, I don't know if you know anything about this, but I don't either. But I'm just wondering if you have any experience at all with knowing about other countries and how they deal with mining and mining permitting.
Mr. Chair, Senator, no, not I'm not familiar with the environmental review laws of other countries.
Thank you.
I thought Senator Fredrickson. Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Dibble, you had your hand up.
Thanks, thanks, Mr. Chair. Going back to the EPA letter that we received a few days ago, just in answer to one of your questions, it seems like they do combine both the kind of the technical review comment, but also they talk about the adequacy issue within this letter as well. So I think they combined their comments. They say that it doesn't adequately study some of the hydrological profiles to the full extent that they should. But my question was, going back to Senator Anderson's questions about kind of the EPA's authority, and you had mentioned the Council on Environmental Quality, the CEQ, and they talk in this letter about referring the matter to the CEQ. Who are they, and what is that? What is that process? What does that mean?
Mr. Calder.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the Council on Environmental Quality is, I guess, kind of the overseer of federal environmental review. It's a federal agency in charge generally overall of environmental review law, rules, regs, procedures, and some procedures and policies.
Follow up.
So what does it mean, then, if the EPA were to refer this matter to the CEQ? By what authority do they do that, and what comes of the EIS and the whole process?
Mr. Colvin.
Mr. Chair, Senator, if if it's referred to the CEQ, I presume it would be because the Corps and the EPA as two federal agencies could not agree on a forward course of action on the moving from the draft EIS toward the final EIS. And so the CEQ would be brought in to kind of decide, mediate, or arbitrate, I guess, how NEPA or Federal Environmental Review will be satisfied.
So, Mr. Chair, so that process would need to be, I mean, if that does come to pass, it would have to go through the CEQ negotiation, as it were, or, you know, they'd have to kind of settle on something that's mutually agreeable before then permits could be issued?
Mr. Colvin.
Mr. Chair, Senator, if the two agencies can come to some sort of acceptable solution, it's not mandatory that it go to CEQ. However,
I'm asking if it
passes. if it goes to CEQ, then yes, then CEQ, whatever CEQ decides goes, and that would be before the Corps could issue their permit.
Thank you,
Mr. Colvin. Are you aware of what other regulatory acts this project would be subject to after EPA and the NEPA?
Mr.
You
Chair.
You mentioned the wetlands, clean water.
Mr. Chair, the various permits and approvals associated with the project are going to be listed in the environmental impact statement itself. I can't give you an exhaustive list off my head, but some of the examples would be water quality permits or National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System. That's a federal authority, EPA authority, delegated to the state of Minnesota and administered by the Pollution Control Agency. Air quality, same thing. Wetlands, there's the Federal Wetlands Act. Again, that's out of the Clean Water Act. There's also a Wetland Conservation Act that's administered through our agency for mines. There's the permit to mine. There will be public waters work permit, I believe. There will also be water appropriations permits associated with this. And I believe there's some local zoning permits, just as some examples of some of the permits and approvals the project will face as it proceeds.
And with regards to the federal regulations, is it the EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers and possibly the CEQ that are the agencies they would deal with, or are there others as well?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, I forgot a big one in this particular case, and that's the U.S. Forest Service. In so much as the mine site is located currently on Forest Service land, the Forest Service must approve a land transfer before the project can proceed.
How about tribal impacts?
Mr. Chair, the various tribes within the general affected area are cooperating agencies in the federal process, specific kind of the federal side of the process, if you will, in the EIS, and we have a memorandum of understanding that they've been involved throughout the development of this. In addition, both the Corps of Engineers and the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency are in their reviews and in their approval processes considering both tribal impacts and tribal trust issues.
Thank you. Senator Olson, then Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Colvin, in the case of the National Forest Service, you said they need to transfer the land. If the project is a deep underground mine, the land, the part that will be disrupted, or all of the land under which the mining will occur?
Mr. Chair, Senator, so you're asking if would a land transfer be required if it were a subsurface mine?
This is going to be the EIS tonight.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'm not really qualified to answer that. Perhaps an official from the company is aware of the answer to that.
And I'm informed that a lot of these questions, including mine, are going to be addressed in as we review the actual draft EIS tonight. Okay. We will cover these topics. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is more related to the DNR, and the question is, I was struck by the language of the EPA letter is pretty strong, and I'm wondering, is that typical to get EPA comments that say that this draft EIS is inadequate and will result in environmental water quality impacts that are unsatisfactory? Is that a typical response from them, or have you seen that before in DNR EISs?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I have not seen that before in EPA letters to us. I have seen it before in EPA letters. I would say it's not common, though I would also point out that EPA was somewhat critical in their comments, even on our KTAC EIS.
Mr. Colvin, would you mind kind of covering the high points of the rest of your presentation? And we may or may not have questions along the hearing process as well.
Okay, Mr. Chair, let's just hit a couple things. I think one thing, you know, the EIS does some things really well, and there's some things it doesn't do. It helps us understand effects. We take a hard look at significant effects. We've talked about exploring ways to reduce effects, providing early public access to regulatory agencies to make better informed decisions. It's not an approval in and of itself, nor does it guarantee that a permit will be issued. And it's not intended to analyze every conceivable impact. And that gets back to the analytical, not encyclopedic. We've, I think, talked about most of this. Joint state-federal review, I think we've hit those high points. Just wanted to point out a couple of differences between the state and federal environmental processes. The state Environmental Policy Act has time frames. It's interesting to note that the federal Environmental Policy Act and rules don't specify time frames. I mentioned that the record of decision, the end game for the NEPA process, is a regulatory decision. Because of that, in the federal process, and you'll see this reflected in some of the EPA comments, are looking for something closer to what we might call a permitting level of analysis in the EIS itself, whereas traditionally our state environmental reviews haven't gone that far in some of the analyses. Proposers required to pay in the state process. In the federal process, preferred alternative or something called the least environmentally damaging practicable alternative need to be identified at some stage. We don't need to do that in the state process. And then in the federal process, we get this formal concept of cooperating agencies with specific roles and responsibilities. The reason I bring these things up is because they have arisen and caused complications at times, and we're navigating our way through these things. The differences must be managed so that we can reduce, minimize, confuse, confusion and frustration associated with the process. I think that's about it.
Thank you. Senator Phoebe?
Mr. Chair, I'm trying to get my head wrapped around some of this, and I think a few of us have questioned this letter that's been brought up by a few other committee members, and that may be helpful for the rest of us to have.
I have the letter for this afternoon for the evening.
I'm informed that we can have a copy of the letter for this evening, and that would probably be more appropriate anyway because we're actually covering the EIS itself this
okay.
evening. Further questions for Mr. Colvin? Ms. Engstrom, would you be willing to give us your talk this evening?
Certainly.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Senator Dill?
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, as I was sitting here listening, I was thinking about the time I was a chief author of the generic environmental impact statement study on animal feedlots. And we pulled together about 30 people from a wide range of organizations to sit down and try to decide what was appropriate. And at the front end of the process, they decided that they wouldn't put anything in the final report unless everybody agreed. You had to get 100% consensus on different questions. And that was an unreasonable level of agreement, because you get 30 people in a room to try to agree on complicated scientific, biological, social issues, and it's pretty hard to do. But I'm just going to ask Mr. Colvin, I don't think they do it that way. At least I hope they don't. This was a generic environmental impact study on animal feedlots, but I would think when you're actually doing an EIS, I would hope that your decisions are based on chemistry, biology, science, facts, statistics, research, and so on, and you wouldn't have to get 100% agreement from a broad range of people from diverse backgrounds.
Mr. Chair, Senator, certainly we are endeavoring to use science and professional judgment to the best of our capability to generate information in an environmental impact statement. But we also recognize the value of the public process, and that those in the public may have perspectives or information that's valuable as well and can help us make a strong document at the end of the day.
Polymet, are you okay with presenting tonight? Do you have anyone that cannot, and you'd like to maybe have briefly speak now, or are you okay to give your full presentation this evening?
This evening is fine.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. So, members, tonight's hearing is in G15.
What should we do with our?
So, please put all your materials in your folders. And we are at what time tonight? 6 p.m. tonight. We will see you at in room G15 at 6 p.m. We need to recess or adjourn. Committee is in recess.